The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This installment of the ConcertCast is brought to you by Orion, a nonprofit ad-free magazine about culture and the environment. The current issue of Orion features Jim's latest essay on cities of the future. To read that essay and listen to a full-length podcast interview with Jim, visit orionmagazine.org/cities. Also on that page, you can sign up for a free trial subscription to Orion for just $19. Orion will also be featuring a live web event with Jim on July 12th and an in-person panel featuring Jim and other Orion contributors atop Mount Greylock in Massachusetts, Sunday, July 17 at 5 p.m. Hey everyone, it's Duncan Crary. You're listening to The ConcertCast, a weekly conversation about the tragic comedy of suburban sprawl featuring James Howard Kunstler. Jim is the author of The Long Emergency, The Geography of Nowhere, and The World Made by Hand novels. On today's show, we're going to be wrapping up our discussion about Ed Glaser's talk that he gave at the Congress for the New Urbanism last month. Ed Glaser is a professor of economics at Harvard and author of the best-selling book Triumph of the City. As with last week, I'll be playing clips of his talk and then allowing Jim to respond and expand on some of the ideas. If you want to hear this talk in full, you can visit cnu.org, and all the recordings are available to members. And once again, if you'd like a free audiobook of Triumph of the City, you can visit audiblepodcast.com/Kunstler. So Jim, Ed also talked about transportation and subsidies. So let's play that clip and we'll be back in one sec.
And I know it is tempting, it is hard not to think that we want to push Washington to spend more on high-speed rail or other transit projects. But remember, the cost of that transit is more highways, right? It always is going to have to run through the Senate. There's always going to be a deal that goes forward on this stuff. And it's not always obvious that once you get the federal government paying for these transit projects that you get such great ones as the People Mover suggests. I have a great deal of sympathy for the words of John Norquist that defederalizing our transport system would help transit compete with the automobile. And I think that's something that I very much want to throw out. This is the work of Kahn and Baum-Snow that shows that many of these projects actually achieved very modest impacts on increased transit use, Washington, D.C. being an exception. But overall, this is an impact of 2% increase in the share of transit riders, people using transit to get to work in areas that built new rail stops. And again, I don't think this is a general problem with building smart transportation, smart transit. I think the problem is that often the ones that are backed by the federal government are highly problematic, and we really do need to rethink those.
Well, this really brings out the old econometrician in Ed Glaser. It ends up just being about numbers of things, and mostly numbers of things that were there in the past, not necessarily what's going to happen in the future. I think it's self-evident that we're going to have a hell of a lot less capital in the future to really subsidize anything. So, the idea that we're going to be bringing these $500 million. $2 billion bundles of financing to public projects like, new streetcar lines and stuff like that, I think is going to be rather unlikely. We don't know what kind of public or private endeavors and partnerships might come along. It could be very difficult. I'm personally supposing that our financial life in the decades ahead is going to be much more disorderly than it has been, and much more sort of scant, that we're not going to have very much money to do any of this stuff. And we've been lucky that we built the urban streetcar lines that we did in the last 20 years in places like Portland and Dallas. But it remains to be seen whether we're going to have a whole lot more of that activity. We were lucky that we got a DC subway line in place and that BART was built in San Francisco. The question now is really, it may be more a matter of, are we going to have enough capital to even maintain this stuff? The big question for the cities is managing contraction. And the big question for managing contraction will be public spending and the repair, the ongoing repair of everything from our water systems to, you know, to our electric lines to, you know, all the stuff that's really crucial to anything like modern civilized life. I think it's going to be a real struggle. I think we'll see things where, you know, whole systems go down or get to a point beyond repair where you really can't bring them back, where maybe whole neighborhoods or whole districts of cities, you know, are no longer served by the infrastructure that they were used to getting in the 20th century. And all of a sudden, you know, well, sorry, it's gone here. And, you know, in the southwest quadrant of Columbus, Ohio, you know, we just don't know. So to make projections about, you know, percentages of people who take cars and streetcars or light rail now, you know, I think is going to have not a whole lot of application for what happens in the future.
We get smart by being around other smart people. Cities make that happen. Young people who come to cities, come to urban areas, experience a series, an onrush of learning that they couldn't possibly have if they had stayed in low-density areas. There's a reason why our most famous example of geographic concentration today is Silicon Valley, the industry that is most technologically sophisticated, that you might think would be most prone to disperse, to locate far away and use their technology. But no, those software engineers feel like they have to be there because they need to learn. And of course, you know, anyone who's ever taught knows the hard part of teaching, the hard part of lecturing is not knowing your script. It's knowing whether or not your audience gets it. And we have evolved over millions of years to have these cues that signal comprehension or confusion. And those cues are invaluable if you're trying to get stuff across. And no, you know, decades of technology can't overrule millions of years of evolution. Now, of course, the impact of skills, ideas causing the rebirth of cities means that the success of cities have come to some places and not to others. Okay, particularly skills have predicted which cities come back. This is the general correlation between skills and urban success over the 30 years. This is the particular role in the Northeast and the Midwest. Detroit and New York and Boston are doing exactly where you think their skill level should put them as being. Places that have more share of the population with college degrees in 1970 have done substantially best, and Detroit continues to face the hurdle of the fact that only 12% of its adults have college degrees. This is the relationship between share of the population with a college degree in 2000 and across counties in the entire U.S. across the past decade. As the share of the population in your metropolitan area with a college degree goes up by 10%, your wages go up by 8%, holding your skills constant. These are called human capital externalities. It pays to work around smart people, and these effects are stronger in dense areas. Education also proved to be highly protective during the current downturn, during the recession. Skills are, of course, not just about the things you learn in college. Many of the most important things that areas have is a culture of entrepreneurship and ability to start things up. And measures of entrepreneurial skill, like average firm size, do a remarkably good job of predicting which cities have managed to come back. Detroit isn't just less skilled. It has no culture of, or very little culture of entrepreneurship. GM, you know, and Ford got rid of that, and that's also part of its problem. Whereas New York had the garment industry, which was a mother of entrepreneurship, which was a place that was easy for anyone to get started, and, you know, there are scores of people who have come up through the garment industry now.
So Ed Glaser is making the point that the cities that have a higher share of college-educated citizens are the ones that are guaranteed to be the most economically successful. Well, maybe that's been the case. You know, I think that higher education is one of the more endangered systems in our culture now. It's gotten into a huge amount of trouble by becoming a kind of government-based tuition debt racket, which has now reached such a degree of awkwardness for the people involved. And by that, I mean the students who have to carry, you know, $100,000 debt burdens as they go through school and come out of it. You know, I don't see the system really continuing that way. And I in fact, it seems to me that a lot of places are going to get much smaller pretty quick and maybe close. And I'm not sure what higher ed is going to mean. My own kind of picture of the future is that it's going to be much more important to, you know, have practical skills going into the future than it will to have a college education. And I do not think that the economic future of the USA is going to be about innovating more iPod-like devices. I think that we're going to go through a period of time where it's going to be really much more about Can we feed ourselves? You know, can we keep ourselves warm in the winter? Can we find ways to develop local economies where those kinds of things are possible, those really fundamental economic things? And it's not going to be about having thousands upon thousands of gee whiz high-tech web-based firms in a 30-block area all, you know, going out having cappuccino with each other and synergizing their ideas about how an iPod app might work.
Just as New York has become more and more attractive, the city has built less and less. The average height of new condominiums in New York, by some measure, has declined very substantially over the last 30 years. And if, you know, you've got to build in New York, there's no extra in Manhattan, there's no extra land. You've got to either build up or you're not going to add more units. And while there's so much that I've learned and I admire about Jane Jacobs and so much that she got exactly right, this is an area that she actually got things wrong. And I'm specifically talking about her view that, you know, she looked around, she noticed that old buildings were cheap and new buildings were expensive. And as such, she thought that the way to keep New York cheap was to preserve old buildings. And she fought for preservation. Now, there are many good reasons to fight for preservation. My father was an architectural historian, and I believe our great works of architecture are, you know, America's are the world's priceless heritage, and they need to very much be protected. But that's not true of every undistinguished glazed brick building in the Upper East Side of Manhattan. And indeed, Jacob's logic is completely wrong, that in fact, you don't actually make a place affordable by stopping new building. There's no repealing the laws of supply and demand, right? If there's a lot of demand for an area and you don't supply new units, prices are going to go up, as we've seen in New York so clearly, as we've seen so clearly in her own Greenwich Village Historic District, right? Which when she lived there was affordable to ordinary people like her and her husband. Ordinary, I guess, only in income. Not in any other way was Jane Jacobs ordinary. But today, no one who is not a hedge fund manager can think about buying a townhouse in Greenwich Village. This is what freezing the city in amber has wrought. It doesn't mean that it was wrong, but it always means there's a cost. And every time we say no to new building, we're saying no to a family who wants to live in the area and we're telling them they can't move in. Doesn't mean that it's necessarily always right to say yes to a new project, but it does mean we always have to weigh off costs and benefits on this.
So Ed says, you know, we got to build up. And I think one of the main themes in his new book, The Triumph of the City, was that we are going to be seeing more skyscraper cities and more skyscrapers, and that's what it's all about. Now, I found it strange that in his keynote to the CNU that he really kind of downplayed that whole thing until pretty near the end. And by the way, he started it by saying, you know, Jane Jacobs, the great iconic figure of the new urbanism, Jane Jacobs was wrong, because Jane Jacobs was interested in preserving older, smaller structures. But, you know, ironically, I think it may not be that, you know, we have to preserve old structures in order to live at a scale that is going to be consistent with the realities of the future. They don't have to all be old, but I mean, we're going to have to get into the mentality of living at a smaller scale. And probably, you know, somewhere between 4 and 6 stories is going to maybe be the maximum for us. And so Ed is very much in favor of promoting as much density as possible and delivered in skyscrapers optimally. And I have a pretty serious beef with that. You know, I do not think that the skyscraper is going to be a building type that will prove to have a future. I think that we're going to look through the rearview mirror 100 years from now, maybe around the campfire, and we're going to understand that the skyscraper was a product of a particular time and place and economy, namely a cheap energy economy that existed in this part of the Western world for about 150 years. And when that cheap energy economy is over, the skyscraper is over. And it's not just about the elevators. I mean, people have pointed out many times that the elevator is the most efficient form of public transportation that there is, you know, and it's probably true. You know, you get a counterweighted elevator, meaning, you know, it's a thing that requires very little power to set in motion because it's got a counterweight in it. It's sort of exquisitely balanced. So that's true. But, you know, my question is really, first of all, are these economic relationships that allow skyscrapers to exist in the first place going to continue? Like, are you going to need that much office space to even own a 60-story office tower in Houston or Atlanta? Or in fact, is the corporate organization of life going to change so severely that we're not going to have that many people working in giant office buildings, and not necessarily because of the web and telecommuting. Really more because that form of corporate organization is just not going to work in a non-cheap oil economy, and we're not going to have giant corporations anymore the way we've had them, the way we've understood them. They won't be there. And and that we'll relocalize, and that we'll be doing everything at a smaller scale. So that's one way of economically making a skyscraper possible. You have a huge demand for office space in large quantities from big entities, and they rent a lot of space. The other one is one we've already discussed, is that, you know, you manage to build a condominium building where you can sort of subdivide the ownership into as many units as you've got units in the building. And, you know, that allows you to raise enough money every month to care for the building and pay for the maintenance. You know, I've already said why I think that's going to be a problem. Well, now, you know, we're seeing a phenomenon where a lot of guys who were in the condo business over the last 20 years are making a shift into the rental apartment business. They're deciding actually mid-project. You know, the project, let's say, was already designed in 2008. And finally, you know, they got all the financing and they're putting the building up. But they've decided that they're not going to do it as a condominium. They're going to do it as a rental building. And that means that there's not going to be a homeowners association, so that the person who develops the building ends up being the owner of it. And they will end up being responsible for the care and maintenance of the building, which is quite a big assignment, because it means over time, you know, this is something you are now in the building care business, not just the building construction business. That, by the way, was the model in places like New York and Chicago in the 1920s, you know, where you get the giant pre-war apartment buildings and, you know, the 20-story buildings. Those were giant back in that day. But most, you know, they were almost entirely rental buildings. You know, my mom grew up in a large apartment on Park Avenue and 84th Street in New York, but they rented that apartment for 25 years. And the company that owned it, you know, they were responsible for the property. So the whole condo thing has been a way of offloading the responsibility for the care of a giant megastructure from the people who construct it to the people who are now the owners of it in a tribe of owners. And what we're seeing now is, because it's becoming increasingly difficult to do that in some places, not necessarily Manhattan, but in some other, it has happened here in Saratoga, where, you know, for a town of this size, about 30,000 people, we had an extraordinary building program for the last 10 years. You know, we got something like 8 or 9 buildings that are about 5-6 stories high. And, you know, the first 7 of them were condominiums. And now, you know, one of the biggest ones that came latest in the game, which was originally designed as a condominium building, you know, they can't sell the condominiums. And then the next one, the last one that's being constructed in the cycle, which is now under construction, you know, the steel is just going up now, that one is going up just as a rental building. And so that, you know, the developer of that building, who built 3 other condo buildings in town, will now be in the property care business, not just the construction business. So that's going to change a lot about the decisions that are made about building megastructures. And then there's finally the other issue that's sort of associated with the peak oil and peak everything issue, is that we're facing this problem where we're going to have scarcity is not only of, you know, basic energy resources, but also of a lot of the stuff that we use to build things, you know, of just the metal ores that we're finding are lower and lower grade every year. You know, there's less good copper, there's less good iron ore, there's less good nickel, or, you know, anything you can name. And we're going to have less energy to mine the stuff and to turn it into, you know, useful materials and into modular fabrication stuff and into building materials. And so I really wonder whether we're even going to be able to keep these things fixed. I even wonder whether there's going to be something like a sheetrock industry as we've known it. You know, what if there's not? You know, what if we can't do that? And you've got, you know, sheetrock is one of the basic things that you have to change out about every 30, 40 years. You know, especially in places like the Sun Belt where, you know, you have a lot of air conditioning and stuff gets moldy after a certain number of years and, you know, you've got to change it out. Well, what happens if there's no more sheetrock industry and all of a sudden, you know, what are you going to do? Go in to a 38-story building in Atlanta and plaster all the walls with horsehair and plaster of Paris, you know, or put up wainscoting, you know, made out of wooden tongue and groove? I mean, these questions are things that are hardly being asked by the people who are in these industries and, you know, not just the construction industry, but the, you know, the developers and the people who finance them. And they're all waiting there like booby traps to change the way we live. And I do think that it's going to especially redound to this whole issue that Ed Glaeser is championing of, you know, the glittering city of skyscrapers. And I just thought it was kind of bizarre that he soft-pedaled the skyscraper issue. I don't know whether it's because, you know, he had some sense that people in the CNU were questioning the idea of the megastructure remaining the normal kind of strategy for building cities. But it's possible that he had an apprehension of that, and he, you know, he seemed to rely more on his other econometric arguments than on the thing that he's really, really pushing.
Well, Jim, he did also discuss the burgeoning cities of Asia and the difficulties that he foresees in enforcing height restrictions on them, which would apply to skyscrapers.
I'm going to skip over this, but the point here is that the places that build a lot in America aren't expensive, and the places that are expensive don't build a lot. Housing supply is really shaping America. And this is even more important in places like Mumbai, which has labored in much of the city under a floor area ratio of 1.33 for much of the past 30 years. Right? It is easy to see why you want to preserve Paris or parts of London. It is very hard to see why you want to, you know, lock Mumbai in a straitjacket. Right? It is very, very hard to see how this makes sense, and particularly as we think about the environmental challenges that are posed by the growth of the cities of Asia, and it's very hard to see restricting heights, restricting urban development.
Well, his point there really was that you can't put height restrictions on buildings, and that, you know, he seems to apprehend that as being a very troublesome matter. And in fact, I think the CNU members are keenly aware that maybe height restriction is a very important part of the toolkit for the future design of cities because, you know, we are facing these real problems of management and construction and reconstruction and financing of large megastructures. And I think the CNU members are aware that there is a sort of not a maximum building height, but an optimum building height that works best in cities. You know, some of our models do admittedly come from the European idea of, you know, the central city that is not much more than seven stories. You know, not that that is necessarily the way things always have been or always will be, but it seems to be a pretty good model. You know, the center of Paris is very vibrant at seven stories maximum, and we're aware of this. So, you know, there's an idea in the new urbanism, I think, that maybe we do have to be sensitive to the size and scale of cities in the future, you know, for many reasons. So Ed Glaeser is really looking towards the past again in the rearview mirror and saying, oh, you know, well, we know how to build 60-story condominiums. Let's just build more of them. But I really don't think that's the way things are going to work out.
Okay, so Jim, to wrap this up, let's play Ed Glaeser's parting thoughts to the CNU.
And I want to just end on this point on the environment with a little anecdote. This is an anecdote about a young Harvard graduate who, in a beautiful spring day in 1844, went for a walk in the woods outside of Concord. And he did a little fishing. The fishing was good because there hadn't been much rain lately. And when he came to cook the fish in a chowder, the wind flicked the flames to the nearby dry grass, and the flames spread, and it spread, and it spread, and soon an inferno resulted, which, by the time it was over, had, you know, leveled more than 300 acres of prime Concord woodland, had destroyed a natural habitat. Now, in his own day, this young man was castigated as an enemy of the environment. The Concord Freeman, understandably enough, called him a flibbertigibbet, which I think was pretty bad for 1844. And indeed, It is hard to think of anyone during that person's age living in Boston or Cambridge who did as much damage to the environment as this young man did. Now, oddly, today he is revered as the secular saint of American environmentalism, Henry David Thoreau, whose book taught a lesson about how we should all live surrounded by green space and do wonderful things for the world by doing so. The odd thing, of course, is his life teaches a different lesson. Wouldn't the environment have been better served if he had stayed home and tended his books in Cambridge? Right? Surely his life teaches us that we are a highly destructive species, and if we love the environment, we should actually stay away from it. This comes from work of Matt Kahn and myself. We're actually measuring the carbon emissions for a standardized household, standardizing by income and family size, and this shows the carbon emissions from household emissions in different parts of Boston. I want to, you know, just as full disclosure, I actually moved when I started acquiring small children. You can tell I'm an economist. Only economists talk about acquiring small children. When I started acquiring small children, I moved to a place not far away from Thoreau's Lake, and like as David Owen recounts in his wonderful Green Metropolis, I also started doing as much environment to the harm to the environment almost as much as Thoreau himself did when I moved out there. I have to move through this because I'm done. I do just want to say, across metropolitan areas, there's a very strong connection between the centralization and the density of the metropolitan area and the degree of greenness, right? One factoid to have in mind is that as the share of the population, as you compare apartments with single-family detached houses, electricity use is 83% higher in single-family detached houses than it is in urban apartments. And of course, as you spread people out, there's much higher gasoline usage. And it's not just an issue of public transit versus driving, right? The density of the environment makes a huge amount of difference to the gas that you use, even if you are a driver, that in fact compact development has all this value. Now, I want to just lay out this challenge to CNU, and I'm going to end with this. There are many things that we can do to green our country, but ultimately, everything that we do here is less important than what will happen here, okay, and what will happen in India, right? That in fact, if America cuts its household sector emissions by 50%, right, that'll mean cutting our total emissions by 20% as a country. Good thing, absolutely valid thing to do. But if China and India see their per capita carbon emissions rise to the levels currently seen in the sprawling West, global carbon emissions go up by 127%, right? If they stop at the level seen in prosperous but hyper-dense Hong Kong, global carbon emissions go up by 25%. And as you think about what CNU faces, think about what it means for China. Think about what it means for India, because that's the battlefield. And that's the place where building it at higher densities, building compactly, will have the greatest value for reducing the world's carbon emissions. And that's where, in fact, building up means not building out. And that's actually something that's highly valuable. So I will end there, but I will also say that, you know, I didn't mention the challenge of urban schools. That remains the biggest challenge facing our cities in the U.S. I think we certainly want to rethink our subsidizing highways and, again, rethinking our fetish for subsidizing homeownership. So thank you very much for your attention. Yeah.
Well, you know, I thought they were kind of confusing because he seemed to conflate the idea that the CNU was about greenery and green space and greening stuff up. He made some reference to, you know, the greening up the country. And that is not what the CNU is about. We're certainly not against it, and we're certainly not against what I suppose falls into the folder of environmentalism and ecological awareness. But the CNU is not about greening stuff up. The CNU is about the built stuff and how it's integrated into a human ecology that is kind to the planet. And so I wonder, you know, if Ed Glaser in his little econometric ivory tower at Harvard has really paid enough attention to the CNU to even understand what its aims are.
So, Jim, there was a Q&A section at the end of Ed Glaser's talk, and Victor Dover, you know, was sort of a facilitator for the questions. One of the questions that came up was about Ed Glaser's thoughts on Buffalo. Now, Glaser wrote an op-ed for the New York Sun back in 2007 titled, "Can Buffalo Ever Come Back?" It was pretty controversial. We have tons of listeners in Buffalo who are constantly asking me to talk with you about Buffalo. We're going to do that more depth later, but let me just play part of Ed Glaser's response to questions about Buffalo, and then I'm going to hear your response.
No, on the question of cold Januaries.
The
question comes from Buffalo, which is a favorite topic of yours. Buffalo is hosting the Congress for the New Urbanism in 2014. We thought of it as being kind of like going to Detroit without going to Detroit in some ways. Now, in spite of continued population loss, it is said to be still the 17th most densely populated city in the United States. Since 2000, the Buffalo MSA had the ninth highest gross municipal per capita growth, the second highest percentage gain in graduate degree attainment, the second highest percentage increase in property values. So Buffalo is somehow growing wealthier and smarter and more valuable, as you say we should. So did you mean Buffalo was too cold and should drop dead just for that?
I don't think I ever told any city to drop dead, literally. No, I mean, you know, I live in Boston. Who the heck am I to throw stones about coldness? Buffalo has a lot of assets. And again, when I weighed in on Buffalo, my intent was exactly the same as I just described in terms of the rail infrastructure, was that we need to think about the investments in Buffalo that make sense and not invest in a lot of fixed infrastructure projects that are justified with some sort of magical thinking that if only we put down a monorail, we will, you know, cause this place to miraculously return back to its 1910 city of light nature. That's not how the world works. And that's the key here. It's not that I don't wish Buffalo well. It's not that I don't actually see a lot of great assets in Buffalo. I mean, a lot of older, beautiful buildings, a great education system, and a great higher ed institution. Lots of great things. But we don't want to engage in this magical thinking that thinks that you want to throw infrastructure declining places and all of a sudden miracles will happen.
It's understandable that people would be kind of pessimistic about where Buffalo's going, and I certainly agree with Ed Glaser that, it's not ever again going to be the Buffalo of 1950 with the smoking steel mills and the grain elevators of the size that they were. But I think something's going to be there, and maybe something significant. There was a time, and it was exactly the time that Ed Glaser mentioned, at the turn of the 20th century, when people thought that Buffalo's future was going to be so stupendous that it would eclipse New York. And the reason for it was its proximity to Niagara Falls, which is probably the greatest hydroelectric site in America. One of the things that we're going to get in trouble with in this country in the decades ahead is the electric grid and our ability to generate electricity and move it any distance. And the places that are closest to really great hydro sites are going to be places that are going to, in my opinion, going to tend to be more successful. And so despite the fact that Buffalo is a very cold place and despite the fact that it seems exceedingly bleak in its current cycle, I think that it is going to enter another cycle where it will be of more importance relatively than it is now, maybe quite a bit more. It also happens to have a very important site on one of the Great Lakes. It was one of the great grain terminals of the United States. It also, it's at the end of the Erie Canal. It is connected into the St. Lawrence Seaway, which is liable to keep going for a while. I don't think that international trade is going to be quite what it was, but the St. Lawrence Seaway is, one of the major inland waterways of North America, and it's going to be important. So, once again, I think that Ed is sort of overlooking the most significant asset that Buffalo really has, which is its great proximity to Niagara Falls and the biggest hydroelectric site in North America.
Okay, and Jim, you and I will be heading off to Buffalo this October.
So. Yeah, I got to give a keynote talk to the National Trust for Historic Preservation, and they're having their meeting in Buffalo. I was in Buffalo about, 6 or 7 years ago, and I got a tour around with an architect, and it was amazing. It was an incredibly wealthy city at one point, and there was one particular avenue there. I don't know whether it was Delaware Avenue or Elm Street or something like that, but there was one mansion after another the size of the Frick Museum in New York City, just these giant Beaux-Arts heaps, and These were homes, private homes, that came like with their own gymnasium attached, and they were selling for like $211,000 or something.
Wow!
the stuff was just so devalued in Buffalo that it was staggering. Now, I'm not saying it would be a good idea for someone like you or me to buy a house like that, because frankly, I don't know how you would take care of a 12,000 square foot private home.
Right.
But it presented some very interesting situations that we're going to be talking about when we go there. And it'll be fun to see the Buffalo, people who listen to this podcast from Buffalo.
Yeah, there's quite a crew out there. And also, I just got my copy of Preservation Magazine this month, and it's all about Buffalo Rising. So we'll have a party when we go there. Yeah. And there's a lot of photographs in that issue of what Jim's talking about, listeners.
Should we invite Ed Glaser to come to that party?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. He might want to talk to you in person after hearing this
and
show.
And then maybe we can super glue him or something.
Okay. All right. But so final thoughts on Ed Glaser, Jim. I mean, we've just sort of gone point by point through his talk.
He's a very interesting specimen of a certain kind of intellectual in America, the econometrician. And, you know, in a way, he represents something that is the worst element of urban planning in our lifetimes. And that is the fact that so much of it has been based on statistical analysis and, you know, moving even beyond that into things like traffic engineering, which also are largely mathematical. And you end up with basically a kind of diagrammatic brain that ends up looking backwards rather than forwards. And I don't think that it's going to be the kind of thing that produces a good urban outcome for us under the very serious challenges we face to remake our economy and rethink what urban form will be appropriate for us in for the rest of our lives.
Okay, well, thanks a lot for that, Jim.
Okay, great to be here.
You've been listening to The Kunstler Cast, featuring James Howard Kunstler. To leave a listener comment, call toll-free at 866-924-9499. Send email to letters@kunstlercast.com. You can listen to all of our past programs, join our email list, find out how to book Jim to speak in your area, and talk about the show with other listeners at kunstlercast.com. I'm your host, Duncan Crary. Thanks for listening.
You love podcasts, the stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcast-free today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcast-free.